That's how I started my career, interfering with the way other people did things. I don't remember there being a lot of comedy at the Radio Authority or the IBA. And their answer to the future of radio was to stop it.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Paul Brown.
When I was nine, I was a cadet member of the Dan Dare Pilot of the Future Horlicks Club. And what you got for joining up was you got a Bakelite rocket with a little nose cone, and you take your nose cone off to have your Horlicks before you went to bed. So that was my first sort of connection of any kind with radio. After that, for some reason or other, I was always very interested in advertising. Not radio advertising, just advertising in general. And I wrote an ad for Marmite. And it went, a piece of bread with butter spread and Marmite. I sent this off. I think I was about 10. And I sent it off and my father said, you were sending this chap, he gave me the name of the managing director on this. So I did it all myself. And we got a year's supply of Marmite back. And after that year, I really can't stand Marmite anymore, but I remember that very distinctly. So that's how I started really thinking about communication, I suppose.
Marmite, the growing up spread you never grow out of.
I won a speech and reading prizes at school, and I was in a lot of amateur dramatics, because that's what I could do, really. And when I left, I went straight to Sandhurst, because I started life as a soldier, and my parents were anxious that I should get out of the house. So they were very pleased that I went and joined the army. And I spent a couple of years at Sandhurst. I did a tour, and then I was lucky enough I got a place at Oxford, and the army paid for me to go. It was an idea at the time that army officers would be sort of rather more rounded if you had a few that had done, if you like, a civilian education as well as a military one. And I went and did that for 3 years. While I was there, I got together with a guy called John Moynihan, who is one of the leading Brexit campaigners, interestingly enough, and who is the ex-chairman and chief executive of BA Consulting. And he and I ran a mobile disco. We ran two, actually. One was called Lace Tulip, and the other was called the Cuddly Pink Koala. And they had different playlists, although we didn't really understand what we were doing at the time. That was essentially it, I think. And I learnt all about the back catalogue of Stax Atlantic, and he learnt how to be an accountant. And since that time, our paths have divided, his towards huge success and mine more humdrum. But that's how I sort of started being interested in popular music and entertainment and stuff. Next, I got posted at the end after about 4 years, because I went on to the States for a bit. And then I got posted to Cyprus. And I was in a thing called the Royal Corps of Transport. It doesn't exist now. It's the Royal Logistics Corps. It's essentially Pickford's in uniform. That's what I was in. Before I went, I was sent this telegram from ROSPA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Accidents, asking me if when I went, I would enrol as Cyprus's Uncle Tufty in order to encourage children not to stand on, not to step in front of large trucks. And I said, yeah, I'll do that then.
Mrs. Fluffytail is taking Tufty and Bobby to the shops. Tufty, what's the right way to cross the road?
And I turned up at the BFBS station, because that's what I was told to do, and I was sitting there in uniform, ready to go and see the station manager, when a guy called Richard Asprey came out of a studio saying, is anybody here know anything about pop music? And I said, oh, I know. And he looked at me and I saw my sort of turkey haircut and stuff. I said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, I used to be in a disco and stuff like that. He said, well, come in, because we've got this pop panel and one of my people hasn't turned up, so you come. So I went in and found myself with a young lady who was, I forget, but she worked on the military base there, and a couple of kids and me and him. I wasn't brilliant, but I got away with it. And as a result of that, we started to talk and all the rest of it. And I really liked the guys at BFPS. And I found myself doing a rock show when I finished work twice a week on BFPS Cyprus. And that's when I started broadcasting. I wasn't terribly good at my choice of music, really, insofar as I played Hendrix and all that sort of thing. I was very influenced by West Coast rock, which was just getting into its own, and bands like Grand Funk Railroad and all the rest of it. And so I was playing a lot of music which really Squaddy didn't want to hear, I think. Although I thoroughly enjoyed it. And let your mama see. I decided that I wanted to work in radio full-time, and it was either that or going on to study for Staff College and all the rest of it, so I announced to the military that I wanted to leave, and they were very upset about it on the grounds that I was under a time bar, because they'd educated me at vast expense and given me a very good grounding in life, for which I've always been grateful. And I was sent off on a sort of punishment posting to Aldershot at a recruit battalion, which I thoroughly enjoyed, actually. It was extraordinarily hard work. It was 7 days a week, and we never sort of finished work until 8 o'clock at night, and we started at 8 o'clock in the morning and all that sort of thing. But I did all of that, and then I got visited by a brigadier who said, "What are we going to do with you?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but as you know, I've said I'm going to leave, and what I'm doing at the moment is possibly useful to Her Majesty, but isn't very useful to me." And he said, "Well, actually, we have a problem in Manning, insofar as we're trying to find presenters to go on Forces Broadcasting, and they're few and far between. And we could post you there as a soldier, if you want." So I said, "Is the Pope a Catholic?" And 2 weeks later, I arrived in Gibraltar, and that's when I joined BFBS. And I went on with BFBS through Gibraltar, and then I got a posting to Germany, running television. At that time, I went and had an interview at BBC Radio 2 with a fellow called Jimmy Kingsbury, who's well known to anybody who reads and listens to your bits and pieces. And he offered me a job. It was a 6-month contract. And I thought, well, now, am I going to... I was starting out, and I've never known it was the right or the wrong thing to do. It probably suited me better, actually, because I think I wouldn't have been terribly good on Radio 2. I would have needed more than 6 months to get my feet under the table, I think. So I started working at BFBS Television in Germany, which essentially was running a tape library in the world's most expensive caravan, which at the time, I think, cost £1.2 million. And the idea was that it was to be wheeled from base to base around Germany until he got to Rheindahlen, building a new transmitter. Well, the transmitters were built by Marconi in a great big link all the way back to the German border, and then fed by a microwave link from the top of London Television or whatever it was in Wembley, thereafter, and the caravan would be scrapped. And I did that for a couple of years, and that was very trying. While I was doing that, I thought, really, my first love is radio. I want to get into radio. And so I came back while I was still working for them, but I took a month's leave, and I touted myself around commercial radio stations. I was doing it, too, when I was married. I'm still married to the same girl, and so she had married this chap thinking he was going to be a general, and he went off to become a disc jockey. And I think she probably initially thought, oh, my goodness me. But she was very supportive and has been all the way through. Well, it's 1977, the summer of 77, and I've titled my way around lots of radio stations. I went to see Keith Skews at Hallam, and I went to see John Russell at BRMB, and I went to see Colin Walters at Piccadilly for the worst interview in my life, I think.
In fact, I can remember walking across the Piccadilly Plaza just before the station went on air, and thinking, I wish somebody had told me what it is they want me to do.
Colin Walters had an interesting way. I mean, obviously, I was never going to work in a Manchester setting, let's put it that way. He just took one look at me and listened to me, and he thought, oh, my goodness. But he does have this habit, or he did then, I'm sure it's all changed now, of putting his feet on the desk between you. So all you could see was the top of his head and the bottom of his feet. You end up by grinding slowly to a halt when you're trying to answer his perceptive questions. But anyway, I ended up at 210 with a chap with a double-barreled name that I'm trying to remember, Neil French Blake. He was a lovely man. And he said, well, we can use you for a bit. We're short of journalists at the moment. Come along and work for a news editor. And I went and was introduced to David Addis, who was a news editor. I'd never worked in news before in my life. And he said, OK, we'll take you on for 4 weeks and see how you get on. And it was in the summer season. I didn't have a home, but I have a mobile home on four wheels. I had a Bedford truck, and I parked that in the car park and lived in that. The breakfast show presenter when I arrived was a guy called Paul Hollingdale.
This is Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Another one of those fabulous songs from the 210 playlist.
He lived in a room above the studio in the radio station. And their other junior jock was Steve Wright, who was very young. I mean, he was 21. He was outstanding. I mean, you just had listened to him for 5 minutes, and you knew this guy was going to be a huge success.
Rise and shine, wakey wakey. It's coming round to 11 minutes to 8. Radio 210 coming at you. 210 metres medium wave, 1431 kilohertz, 97 FM in stereo.
And he and I hit it off. I treated him, I suppose you would say, in an avuncular way, but we got on fine. So I used to ring the front doorbell at the radio station at 5:30 every morning during the weekdays when he was standing in for Paul Hollingdale. And I had to wake him up at 5 o'clock and we put the transmitters on and all the rest of it, and I would go into all the news bits and pieces and get together the news for the morning. And we had a great time. He was extremely funny. I remember he took over Paul Hollingdale's room. I think Paul had gone off to Austria or something, and I hadn't realised that Paul Hollingdale actually was as bald then as I am now. And behind his door, he had a selection of wigs, or toupees, should I say. And every morning, Steve Wright would come downstairs and open the door. He always used to wear a sort of Che Guevara hat, but on top of it, he'd always have a different toupee. And reading the news with a straight face across a desk at Steve Wright, which is the way we used to do the news in those days, without breaking into a smile was extremely difficult. But it was a fun time, and I was there for about 5 or 6 weeks. It was a fire station, and the pole was still in the middle of the station, and it went down into the newsroom and presenters' desks from the programme controller's office. And every now and again, Neil would come down the pole to see us all. I loved Tuono. It was in the really good days when, certainly on Tuesdays and sometimes on Wednesdays as well, the record companies would come round with lavish entertainment available. I mean, you never ever ate on the radio station for a couple of days, and you were looked after by generous people with a whole cloud of records they were trying to persuade you to play. At lunchtime during the week, the programme controller would come in, because we had a Hammond organ in the studio, and he would play requests from the audience. He was brilliant. He could play absolutely anything, you know. Sometimes you'd have to say, hum it, would you? Hum it. And somebody would get this hummed version, and off he'd go. Is that like it? Yeah, and off he'd go. He was very, very good. Neil was very good. Those are the things I can remember about Tuono. It was a fun time. BRMB, well, it was a big station. Birmingham was, I mean, I'm not quite sure why they pulled me in to do swing. I mean, because I was also very inexperienced. I mean, I'd spent a lot of the time I'd spent doing television continuity, either in vision or out of vision, mostly out of vision, and organising a television station. It's rather different to actually communicating on a one-to-one basis on radio. And when I started, I found it quite hard work, filling in for Ed Doolan.
Let me take you back to late August, early September. I was on holidays, driving through Europe, and I was in Venice when I ran into Noel Gordon, who was there filming for Crossroads.
I didn't have any sessions with anybody who said, all you have to do is be yourself and have something interesting to say. This had not been explained to me when I started. So I think it's true to say that when I started trying to swing for Ed, who was extremely good at what he did, I wasn't very good, really. But I had a very nice producer. It was Mike Owen, who was a producer, and he very sweetly led me through the various hoops. And I learnt a great deal in a very short period of time. And then when he'd finished, my contract was not ended. I went on to take the place of a chap called Dave Jameson, who was a really good presenter, and a really good presenter. I went on to work at ATV and also in a number of other radio stations later on. But he got on at 11 and finished at 2. And so I did that for about a year. I didn't get anywhere close to his figures, actually, to be perfectly honest, because he was very good. But I got better as time went on, I think. BRB was a much harder station. I mean, it was a tougher station. I can remember one of the swing jobs I did for a bit was I took over the black dance show which I thoroughly enjoyed doing, but my knowledge of black dance music is not as intensive as it might be, from Nicky Steele, who did it very well and was the afternoon jock in general terms at BRB while I was there. He alas died very young. He'd be very, very nice, a gentle man, and great fun as well. People could ring you straight up on air or off air and tell you what they thought. And I learned a great deal about my presentation style while I was in Birmingham. The one I always remember, Brian Savin, who I worked with there, he invented this chap called Tommy in Brown Hills. And Tommy in Brown Hills was a typical BRMB Midland phone-inner. And you'd have these long conversations with him. We used to use this in trailing. And his great phrase, which absolutely encapsulates middle of this to me, my wife's a Brummie, I should say, is, now, just a minute. Now, just a minute. This was the phrase that was constantly used by Tommy in Brown Hills during the training exercise, and somehow it sort of explains why some people find Midlanders quite difficult. And then I got, they realised that as I was only a so-so jock, I'd better be turned into a manager, and I became operations manager at BRMB, responsible for training. And I did that partly paid for by the IBA, who had this idea out of secondary rental that we should be doing more to pull graduates into commercial radio, both in news and in programming. And we had remarkable success over time. I mean, the most successful in commercial radio terms, I think, is Phil Riley, who we both know very well, who was always used to complain about not being paid enough money from the day he arrived, I remember. And of course he was correct. And complained about the standard of the coffee and the need for there to be vouchers for travel and various things like that. But apart from that, we got on famously, and he was instantaneously, obviously, a very good communicator. He was very good. And the other guy I remember from those days was a chap called John Watkins, who became the producer of Woman's Hour. He was the only male producer of Woman's Hour, I think, in those days, for quite some time, and then he went on to do You and Yours and various other things on BBC. But he came out of the BRMB training wing, as we rather grandly called it at the time. And I enjoyed that very much, but I wanted to get back into radio proper.
This is BRMB, independent radio from the Midlands.
We lost the programme controller. Oh, John Russell, who went to Radio Victory, and I followed him down there, really.
Radio stations are rather like restaurants. If you go to a restaurant and you have a bad time, bad meal or bad service, you never go back.
But he left, and Bob Hopton took over, who called all of us Vicar, which is very useful. Very useful if you can't remember people's names. And he was a live wire. I like Bob a lot. He did say to me, you ought to start going to be a programme controller, you know, because you're not going to get my job. And you're only so-so as an ops manager. It's time for you to move on. I mean, we didn't part company on it, but I could tell that perhaps I would start thinking about doing something else. I wanted to anyway. So I went off on a press trip to Ireland, which were always very boozy affairs, to do little holiday programme pieces. And I went off. There were five of us on this from all over the place, and one of them was from the South Coast. It was the programme controller down there, who is a bloke called Jack McLaughlin, who in Scotland was a legend, you know. And he was a very good, lively jock. But he really wanted to be in Scotland, not on the South Coast, I think, simply because he'd arrive at about, I don't know how he did it, about 3 o'clock in the morning on Monday, and his show started at six, whatever it was, and he'd leave promptly on Friday as soon as he'd done his programme. But he was also the programme controller. And Radio Victory was an interesting station. It had one or two problems of various kinds, which I won't go into. And we got quite friendly on this trip. And he said, are you looking to move away from what you're doing at the moment? You know, because we talked about it. I said, yeah, I'm thinking of trying to become a programme controller. And he said, well, you know, I've been having a few problems at Radio Victory. And I said, I had heard that. He said, why don't you put in an application now and see how you get on? And I did that, and after about 3 or 4 weeks of being interviewed by the board and all that sort of thing, I got given the job, and then I was down on the South Coast.
Summertime, 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 victory.
Well, I inherit a radio station with a number of people with very fixed opinions, was the way I saw it. It had a hard row to hoe. It was on the South Coast, so IBA Engineering. I'm a great fan of engineers, but IBA Engineering and the way in which the whole thing was organised in those days meant that it broadcast from a 44-watt light bulb, as far as I can make out. It could barely be heard outside Portsmouth. It didn't have enough clout, actually. It was as simple as that. And its audience area was just too small. And it had a bad reputation from the start. I remember getting very upset with Nick Higham, who in Broadcast magazine described the radio station as being irredeemably naff. Got my dander up a bit, really, and I was determined that we wouldn't be irredeemably naff. Everybody worked extremely hard there. We had some lovely people there. Every day we were involved in some kind of marketing activity. We had a thing called a radio taxi, and the radio taxi would go out, and I started doing all these competitions, actually in the streets of Portsmouth and in Havant and in Lee Park and all those areas. And we were great stickers. Julia Fordham was one of our stickers. Don't ask me why. We had some very good journalists there. Mark Easton was the father of the chapel, and now is the BBC social affairs correspondent, isn't he? and Andy Boyd, who was the news editor for most of the time that I was there, I appointed him. We had Chris Ryder, who had a great nose for news, and he liked playing dance music a lot on Saturday nights. And we had a very good team of presenters. I was rather anxious that we all saw things the same way. Two or three didn't see things quite the way that I did. And so I said, you know, eventually, because this is the way these things work, they moved on and different people moved in. But we had a young breakfast show presenter who I put in called Bill Padley, who came from the Isle of Wight and was extremely good musically and fun on the radio. We had an ex-petty officer who used to do the travel information called Ted Trafficator, and this sort of thing. And it was that kind of a radio station. But in those days, of course, you had to do lots of other things as well. So we had an arts programme, and we had a country programme, we had a folk programme, and all those sorts of things. I think when I was there, we were quite lucky. We had the Falklands crisis, and we had to work much harder and go to a 24-hour radio station during that. And we had to invent our own. We had an admiral who became, or a retired admiral. He had a very distinguished naval career, but he was our Falklands correspondent. He was just excellent.
Island to island, by linking with the Falklands to chat to Charlie Lowndes and pass messages back and forth between family and friends separated by some 8,000 miles of ocean.
And a lot of people started working in radio for the first time on the 24-hour service. Chris Carnegie started doing overnights at Victory as a result of that. 81 to 84, I was there. There was a lot going on. I think we had the lowest share of any commercial radio station in the UK at that time. I think it ran at about 26%, and a very low reach figure. And we almost doubled that by the time I'd gone. That didn't have much to do with me. It had much more to do with the fact that the Falklands crisis, I think we dealt with that quite well, and we upped our game, essentially. All the time this was going on, I knew nothing about regulation or anything. I wasn't really interested in regulation. I was too busy working from day to day, as you are on a radio station. 257.
Now, with me in the studio, we have a very distinguished visitor, Brian Young, the Director General of the Independent Broadcasting Association. Brian, on behalf of the staff, listeners and friends of Radio Victory, welcome to Portsmouth. And speaking personally, may I say, I'm delighted to meet you.
But the commercial radio stations, or the independent radio stations, as they were called in those days, were taking issue with the way in which the IBA, the Independent Broadcasting Authority, were running things. That was a peculiar arrangement in those days. The radio stations weren't broadcasters. They were programme contractors. They were providing programmes, or 24 hours worth of broadcasting per day, to the IBA, who were the broadcasters. And the IBA owned the transmitters, and they owned the transmitter network. And that did cause problems. And one of the problems they caused was that you had to go past quite a number of programme officers about everything that you wanted to do to ensure that you were fulfilling everything that your contract with the IBA required. And some of that stuff wouldn't get much in the way of listenership and would cost a great deal of money. So the relationship, I think, was always quite a positive one, but it became quite fractious in 1983 and 84. And I think they felt that they needed to have somebody who had some experience at the sharp end, actually working in programmes in the IBA. At least that's the way it was put to me by John Thompson, who was the director of radio in those days, and by his deputy, Peter Baldwin, who I went on to work for when he became chief executive. They advertised and I applied, and after quite some time, after about 6 months, I got the job.
Do you know that all the commercials you hear on this station have been cleared and approved before you hear them?
By law, they must meet the requirements of the IBA Code of Advertising Standards and Practice.
The amount of advertising and when it's...
Well, I was called Head of Radio Programming, which, as everything was initials in those days, my first job as a regulator was to be Herpy. And that's how I started my career, interfering with the way other people did things. It was an interesting time. There was a lot of resistance amongst the IBA members, the people who were appointed to the IBA, not the staff, but the members, to making any change in radio. First of all, they saw themselves as primarily a television organisation, which indeed they were. And their answer to the future of radio was to stop it. Essentially, no more radio stations were advertised. I arrived just at the beginning of that for about 2 to 3 years. That was to let the radio stations get on their feet. They weren't very keen on reducing radio stations' requirements to broadcast classical music programmes and all that sort of thing. And they were dead set against advertising in any way melding into the programming and vice versa. I felt quite strongly, before I arrived, and we talked about this at interview and everything, so I knew I had an amber, if not a greenish light, to make some changes in those areas. So I suppose the principal change that I made as a regulator was to introduce sponsorship, or allow the introduction of sponsorship. But just before I left Radio Victory, I had managed to persuade one of the programming officers, and she was still there when I got there, so she obviously didn't get fired, to allow me to do the Whitbread pub quiz. Now, that was an advertiser's name in the title of a program. And in those days, it was unbelievable, you know, never been heard of before. There was some pressure on from Capital when I arrived to do something better about the chart show, because in those days, I think it was the network chart show, it only just started, in association with Nescafe. And nobody would allow it to be the Nescafe chart show and all that sort of stuff. But slowly but surely, from about 1985, when I got my feet under the desk, really, all that stuff was pushed backwards, and radio stations could sound more commercial. Well, the way in which it works, you put in an application. There are public hearings after you put in your application, and it's extraordinary in those days, I'm sure it would be true now, how well attended they were by all parts of society, but particularly those who felt that their interests would make a difference. After that, the staff who are involved in that particular license application would write a briefing paper for the authority and take the authority through it at a pre-meeting, and then the authority members, the IBA members in those days, would interview the applicants. And they'd turn up with their chairman and their chief executive and their sales director and a few other luminaries and answer questions. And the authority would weigh up what they'd heard and look at the staff work that had been done surrounding the application and award the license. Victory was one of the first to come up, I think. It was certainly the first, I think, to lose its licence. So it caused a bit of a stir when it lost its licence. And not only down here, but also at the IBA. And their chairman took great issue with the decision. But eventually, Lord Thompson had said, "No, I'm sorry, we're convinced that this is the right decision. We're paid to take these sort of decisions. This is the decision." And then the radio station wound down, had their closing broadcast, and the new one started the following morning.
The time is 11:59. Radio Victory has approximately 1.5 minutes left to live. And when you hear the chimes coming from the Portsmouth Guildhall clock, the time will be 12 midday.
I've taken a lot of flack for that, frankly. I'm fond of everybody at Radio Victory. I think that they sort of expected that I could do something about it. And the first thing that happened when the licence came in was I was just taken away from all licensing matters to do with Radio Victory. So I had nothing to do with it. And it's true to say that somehow or other people thought that I might have been some way responsible for it. I've never quite worked out why. I think there were lots of interesting tales about whether I should have been managing director and all this kind of nonsense, which was completely untrue. With the benefit of hindsight looking back on it, it was crazy for the people who owned Radio Victory at the time to feel that they were going to persuade a licensing body to give them a license for Southampton and Portsmouth and great swathes of countryside in between that insisted on basing itself in North End in Portsmouth. Clearly, the company that won decided to place themselves in Fareham, and that worked very well. Yeah, that's the reason I think that Portsmouth didn't get the license. The best presenters from there all went in one way or another to the news station and all did very well there.
Serving southern Hampshire, West Sussex and the Isle of Wight for 10 years, 257 days, this has been Radio Victory.
What happened after Victory, the big turmoil then that arose, was that it was generally felt that the regulator was not doing all that it should to advertise other commercial radio stations. We came out of that and started to advertise radio stations in other parts of the country. But then people, particularly in metropolitan areas, started to say there's room for other radio stations here. And the IBA argued that the, I think it was the 1971 Broadcasting Act, or was it the 79, whichever one it was, prevented this happening because the IBA had to have radio stations that had a broad range of programming. That was a requirement of the law. That was the classical music, the country music, the news discussion programmes, and all that sort of thing, in amongst the pop music. And in the throes of all of this, in about 1989, coming into 1990, I think, the Conservative government had made it clear that they thought the IBA were not doing a particularly good job. It was evident, the fact that they seemed to be unable to license any other radio stations, it was a good indicator of this. And I looked at the Broadcasting Act again and again, and I finally persuaded my boss, who by that time was Peter Baldwin, that actually, provided you'd fulfil the requirements of the Act, it didn't prevent you from advertising other radio stations that did different things. That was my thinking, and it was also the thinking. There was a chap who now works for Ofcom called Paul Boone, who desperately wanted to get into radio in a more meaningful way, and we used to meet at a pub in Wallingham. We met about three or four times, and we came up with this idea that the IBA should be persuaded to advertise supplemental licences, and I took this idea back to the IBA, and I think it was David Vick, who's grasp of the English language has always been better than mine, said no, should be incremental licences. But he could also see this was a great job from David's perspective. Not a good thing too. And the IBA bought it, essentially, and so we started things like Jazz FM and Kiss.
Everybody applauded the moment we got that first song out. It was just amazing.
Then out of that came the other radio stations in other parts of the country. And by that stage, we got into the 90s, and in 1990 or 1991, the new legislation created a thing called the Radio Authority, which was separate to the ITC, which took over the television part of the IBA.
There's a range of commercial radio services, often called independent radio services, and those are the ones that are not publicly funded. They don't get the licence fee money, and they're not part of the BBC's overall control areas.
Well, I was sent off to find somewhere to base us. We went to a number of different places, including above the underground station at Temple. I remember that. It was a very nice building. We went and had a look at it. But eventually we plumped for a place called Holbrook House, which is in Holborn, which was easy to get to, and communications are very good, and it was easy for people to get to us. So that proved to be a very good base, I think. And by that stage, we were into the whole business of the new spectrum that had been discovered. And it had been used by police and other people, and they were cleared off it. I've never been entirely sure where they went, but they were cleared off it, and it became available for broadcast, as simple as that, really. And the decision had to be made, and I think it was made by the Radio Authority, not by the radio division at the IBA, of how to use the new FM spectrum that had been produced. And the debate was, should you use it for national service, or should you use it for local services? And the tension, I think, was between the companies who felt that there were quite enough FM services, and others who felt that there were national opportunities that needed to be grasped, and those who felt, well, they wouldn't get those opportunities and therefore their advertising would be nicked, all that sort of stuff. We ended up with the authority taking the decision, with advice from its staff, that they ought to have a national service, that the rest of the spectrum should be used by local radio. That's what they did.
This is an engineering test transmission in preparation for the new independent national radio service, Classic FM. Transmissions will be in stereo.
The Radio Authority had to license three national services. There were great debates as the Act of Parliament that formed the Radio Authority was going through as to what these national services should be, because the spectrum had become available prior to the start of the Radio Authority. It was decided that there would be enough spectrum, AM spectrum, to allow there to be two national AM services, leaving other FM spectrum to be used by the incremental licences. There'd be enough FM spectrum available to have one national service. And the whole debate was about whether or not it should be a popular music station, because it clearly if it was on FM it really ought to be a music station, that was the general thinking, or whether it's going to be a different kind of music station. And there was a debate in Parliament about how you would not have thump, thump, thump music. Earl Ferrers, I remember, carried this through the Lords. He was a very fine figure of a man and bellowed thump, thump, thump and thumped the table while he was saying it. He said, that's the sort of thing we want to avoid, isn't it, in British radio? So from being an Earl of a peer of the realm, he'd suddenly become a programme controller. and an understanding of public taste. But anyway, that's the way it went.
From Tuesday the 14th of February, Talk Radio UK, broadcasting across England, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales on 1053 and 1089 kilohertz AM.
What eventually came about was that there was a news station, that there was a pop music station, which was Virgin. The other one was called Talk Radio. And then there was Classic FM, was the one that won the license to broadcast non-pop music. And the words non-pop music came out of the legislation. So it was going to be either show tunes, which had a number of luminaries behind it, or classical music, which had a number of people behind it, including Ralph Bernard, for example. And that's what happened. Various things didn't work terribly well. The AM pop service found it very hard going as Virgin. And it was decided that one of the ways they could do something about this, from Virgin's perspective and then from the authorities' perspective, was to make sure that one of the London FM licences would actually go to Virgin. I mean, they applied for it against other people, but the authorities said, that's not a bad way to get ourselves out of this terrible difficulty, that the spectrum that has been taken from the BBC for use on this popular music service isn't really up to snuff. And this would be a way in which we could at least make life a bit easier, which the Radio Authority did.
From April the 10th, you can hear classic album tracks and the best new music on Virgin 105.8 FM. I think that says it all.
Yeah, it was controversial, and I think it was very practical and very pragmatic. I don't think that the world lost anything by it, and I think that one of the three national radio services could have gone under had it not been done. So I think it was the right decision, personally, but you know, others will take a different view, possibly. I think the great debate was whether or not everything should move towards the highest bidder winning all licences when they came up for relicensing, which was obviously going to happen in the first 4 or 5 years of the new Radio Authority's life, because quite a lot of the radio stations were coming to the end of their licence period, which they'd started under the IBA. National radio stations making bids was very exciting. Some paid rather too much, and some paid a fair enough price, I think, for what they got. I think it's probably true to say that the original Talk proposal was quite an expensive one, bearing in mind they also had to provide a Talk radio station, which was never going to be cheap. But it all sort of came out in the wash, looking back at it now, after all these years, and having not been part of that. Classic FM was almost in profit when I left the Radio Authority. Talk radio had gone through a number of different guises, and there had been various concerns amongst Radio Authority members about the rudeness of what was being said sometimes, or the bias that was being shown in some of the phone-ins, allegedly.
I cannot see that the law is at all good at dealing with this. It really is.
I remember David Starkey caused quite a stir, who always called a spade throughout his time with Talk Radio. I thought he was great. But there was that, and I think we'd ironed out the problems for Virgin. In other words, they were content to prod along and develop the service, as they did with some success. What they decided to do was have things called promises of performance to make sure that people did different things, which was something that I was closely involved in, and where they come to cut me in half and I've gone, they'll find those words written on my heart. Well, the promise of performance was designed to make sure that each radio station was clearly different from other radio stations that they were competing with in their area. It was as simple as that, really. I remember we got into a terrible tarradiddle, or at least one of the AIRC members got into a frightful tarradiddle, about the fact that his radio station could no longer play a Britney. It was all about Britney Spears for some reason or other. And there actually was a promise of performance, or a number of them, where tracks by Britney Spears could not be played on one radio station, but could be played on another. I can't for the life of me now remember how this came about, and I'm sure it was entirely down to me, although it doesn't sound like me, but I assume it was. And we were trying to impose restrictions on the market, which no lively, febrile market is going to stand for. And so it was always going to run into the sand. Having said that, the fact that we were able to introduce promises of performance right from the word go, which is how we got incremental radio stations on the air, was all down to promises of performance. Without those, we'd never got away with it. And got away with it's not the right word, because I think actually it did a great deal for radio from the listener's perspective, and I think it did a great deal for radio as an industry, actually. A whole variety of radio stations. We became more like the exciting soundscape that you'd come across in any transatlantic city, for example. And so I'm glad that we did what we did, and I'm glad that the outcome was what the outcome was, and I'm sorry to have upset at least four or five programme controllers of my acquaintance. Yes, I used to go in and out on the train very often with John Walters, who was the producer of John Peel. He was a man of firm opinion, and he gave me terribly hard times about the wordings of Promises of Performance and the inability for anybody with any commercial or indeed creative sense to be able to stick to them. And I was very glad to get off the train on a number of occasions, I have to say, and run away to the car park in East Croydon, which is where we both got off.
The Broadcasting Act gives us a number of sanctions. We can impose a correction or an apology, or we can impose a fine, or we can shorten a licence, or we can revoke a licence.
There was a big change that took place while I was there, and that was that people were no longer recommended and appointed by government, really, and put into the radio authority. They started to be people who had applied to do the job. So you get people who think they're there to make a difference and have a point of view that is important. And one of the skills, I think, of being a regulator, and I think the regulators that I have known have always been able to do this, is that the people with the power, actually, the people who are making the decision, behind whose skirts you hide if that decision is a bit risky or not going to be necessarily understood, are the authority members. So they've got quite a hard and difficult job. And I think they demand very high standards and get them, I think, from the regulators, the people who are employed to do that.
Well, no, I didn't say anything. I'm not allowed to say who to vote for in the London mayoral elections. It's wrong.
Well, no, of course not.
Boris Johnson.
I mean, the excesses that I had to listen to would be whether something was biased or not, and whether or not a caller was being led by the presenter in a certain way, whether there was an opportunity for a reply and all that sort of thing. So a good deal of it was about balance in speech. There weren't very many complaints about music radio stations, except from other music radio stations, and that was a much easier conversation to have. I mean, you couldn't turn around to a member of the public and say, don't be daft, but you could turn around to a programme controller and say, don't be daft, which occasionally one had to do. Comedy was changing at that time, and when I was a regulator, I Want Your Sex by George Michael was regarded as being something which one really ought not to play on the radio. Not necessarily by me, but certainly by people paying my salary, I think, felt that was something that should be prevented. And I can understand that. It was just for the time, you know. I mean, times have changed hugely. Last night, before you came down, I was watching a programme, a tail end of a programme, which is a popular one, I think. It's a drama of some sort, on BBC One, just before the news. This was at 10 to 10, not long after the watershed. And the thrust of it was, if that's a word I want, there was a young gentleman and a lady due to perform on the bed, and he decided that he needed to go out because he needed to relieve himself. So then we move into the laboratory, and there he is relieving himself, sitting down. And then something goes wrong. I couldn't understand what happened with the edit. But he then turns round and has to throw up because he's fiddling with the feces in the toilet bowl. And I thought, wait a minute, this is the BBC. And if you wanted anything that illustrated how the world has changed since I was mincing about doing programme regulation for first the IBA and then the radio authority, well, that sort of says it all, doesn't it? And I think it was a fairly happy place to be. I mean, everybody seemed to get on with each other very well, and I seem to get on with most of them, okay? It was quite an interesting place to be. But we got to a stage where the chief executive was going to go. It became clear that I wasn't going to be the new chief executive, and therefore I had to think of something else to do, because I couldn't just sit there. And I was then approached to become the chief executive of the Association of Independent Radio Companies, as they had become under Brian West, who, if I may briefly say so, was a first-rate director of radio. I could have done with that in writing about what we should be doing for the next 3 years in the radio magazine, but that's a different issue. I thought he did a cracking job. And so I thought he was quite big boots to fill. One of the first things I did when I got there was to say, oh, look, I think X sounds like a Scotsman being sick, and we ought to have a different set of initials. Having gone through life being called Herpy, I'm very sort of, you know, hung up on those sorts of things. And I said, we ought to say what we are. I probably differ with a number of other people who work in the same profession in this. independent radio means very little. What we are is a commercial venture, and we should be proud of saying we're a commercial radio enterprise. And so that's how we came to be called the Commercial Radio Companies Association. And I changed the name, and some people think that's a very bad idea, because somehow it's like saying you come from Portsmouth rather than Hampshire. When it comes to talking to the great and the good, I don't give a stuff. That's what we did for a living, so that's why I changed the name.
XTC, one of the best British bands ever.
Yeah, I think yeah. so.
No doubt about it.
I was listening to the greatest hits in the week, and they're really blinding songs, aren't they?
Yeah. Really amazing.
Non-stop quality.
Yes.
The commercial radio industry was going through an interesting time. First of all, it had started to make money, and we were anxious to keep doing so. But the BBC were starting to become aggressive. They'd become less aggressive. One of the reasons that we started to make money was that the BBC's share of listenership to Radio 1 and Radio 2 went down, because Radio 1 became more of a youth station than it had been before under Matthew Bannister. That was a declared policy of the then Director General, and Matthew Bannister brought it to fruition. Which was useful from commercial radio's point of view, undoubtedly, and I thought was right, actually.
What I said when I took over Radio 1 and began making changes to it was that it would take about a year for Radio 1's audience to stabilise, and I think we've seen in the latest audience figures that have been published very strong signs of that happening.
They didn't like it very much, and so they decided that they would have a pop at commercial radio via BBC Radio 2, and that happened in 1999. All the way through this, we could see this starting to happen. We could see this was going to happen. And we could see quite clearly that we were going to lose a lot of share. And the only way we could get around that as an industry was to have bigger companies that could take on the national services. And the only reason that we were interested in digital was in order to have big companies that could take on the national BBC services, because otherwise we'd just get swept aside. And I think we were quite right to be concerned in that way, and I think that we were quite right in what we saw was about to happen, because in 1999, BBC Radio 2, despite my bleatings to government, all of which fell on deaf ears, was allowed to change its format fundamentally and become, essentially, without the advertisements and with excellent presenters, the equivalent of most of the major city commercial music radio stations, and pushing them to one side with a really commercial, really poppy sound. And I think it's probably true to say that between 1999 and 2002, about 6% share went off commercial radio in audience terms. That's a hell of a lot. And it made the whole business of dealing with agencies and marketers and advertisers more difficult at a time when, anyway, they were beginning to pick up on something which we only vaguely, and I certainly didn't understand virtually at all, but even some of the people I worked for, and most of them were younger than me, didn't get precisely what the internet was going to do as far as speaking to people was concerned, and showing people how to go and buy things and involving them in things, whether it was editorial or commercial or whatever. That was a real problem, and the Radio Authority were not on board for that at all. They didn't like what we wanted to do about radio station ownership. I can sort of understand it, and I think it got to a funny old stage. I mean, it was very difficult for me, because I found that I was having to argue with people who I rather liked, but I was having to argue with them quite strongly. I think that commercial radio, I'm about to say this one, because I was involved with them at the time, and I was the chief executive of the Trade Association at the time. I think it was quite right to push for the ownership changes, because it was the only way that we could take on the BBC. And having gone through the rather difficult period over the last 4 to 5 years, and until about 2 years ago, where we were fighting tooth and nail to get revenue back from internet marketing.
Billboard here, and these lads what work in advertising with their ponytails and their day-glow glasses, they can make us buy out we don't want, can't they? They don't put their brass just anywhere, but on a winner. So when I tell you that in 1993, money spent on advertising grew by 4%, but money spent on...
I think it started to pay off, but the only way in which commercial rate companies can make any money is by reducing their staffing and doing more networking and so on and so forth. And that has been allowed to happen, finally. And I think the problem with the relationship with the Radio Authority, which I found particularly difficult, was that... And I would have done the same thing if I'd been in the Radio Authority. They tended to turn around to government, with whom they had a very good relationship, and say, if you let these people do this, then they will be awful, and we're telling you they're awful. So we got to the stage where our licensor said we were awful, you know, both in meetings and behind closed doors and in public. And I thought that was a difficult time. for me. I mean, who cares whether it's difficult for me? I just thought it was a difficult time. And I'm glad sort of moved on, really, from that. Because I personally think that Ofcom was quite a good idea. And I thought Stephen Carter was an excellent first chief executive. It was a good thing from radio's point of view, reducing the regulation down to the sort of level that it is now, where silly things about advertising regulation, which is about all that's left, really, to be swept aside, are slowly beginning to sort of evaporate. I think it was the right thing to do.
5 million digital radios in the UK so far. So who's listening?
I bought one for my nan for Christmas.
While I was doing that, I did a number of things. I became chairman of the UK Digital Radio Forum. I became quite involved with World DAB, not hugely, but quite involved, at the European level. I was never too sure about DAB, to be honest. I don't think anybody was. I don't think it's worked out exactly as people thought it would work out, and it certainly has done nothing to weaken the competition from the BBC, who have, with the kind of investment they've been able to make and with the skillful lobbying and marketing they always undertake, done very well with things like BBC Radio 6, I think, has been tremendous. I think BBC 5 Live on DAB is a hugely useful. I think BBC Radio 4 Extra, for old fogies like me, the BBC radio player, as indeed the radio player on the commercial side. So all that digitisation, I think, has started to pay off. I think it was particularly difficult for us until such time as you could have national DAB services via the DAB route, like LBC, for example, starting to get into most homes in the land. That was quite an interesting thing to do, and I think the outcome is probably broadly what, which I'm sure it's not entirely what Quentin Howard, for example, wanted at the time when he was really pushing hard, but he's a very determined man, and I think it's almost as he probably foresaw it, I would think. I quite enjoyed the Radio Academy stuff I was doing. I was chairman of the Radio Academy at an interesting time. I'm very old school, so I think sort of industry should stick together despite their differences. I can remember going to see Richard Eyre shortly after he'd started at Capitals, and they weren't supporters or subscribers to the Radio Academy at the time, and I wasn't chairman. I just said, are you sure you don't want to have anything to do with this? I mean, you know, the Radio Festival is quite an interesting place to pick up just vibes, really. And he said, well, to be perfectly honest, and there's a lot in this, certainly I didn't argue with him, I just sort of left the room with my tail between my legs, but he said, I don't think there's anything in common between us and the BBC at all. We're totally different ventures, and you only think it's the same simply because you're an ex-broadcaster. Actually, we're different, and we have nothing in common with the BBC, and there's no point in talking to them. I'm not entirely sure that was entirely correct, but I think there was something in that. But having said that, I'm a great believer in industry things, cross-industry or single-industry things. I suppose the things that I remember with the greatest pleasure from being chairman was that I brought about the Hall of Fame. I invented that. Everybody has to do something when you're chairman of a body like the Radio Academy, and that was my thing. But I think that worked well and continues to work in various guises, I think, going forward. And I think it's quite good to have commercial broadcasters and BBC broadcasters on the same platform, and it's still doing that. And the other thing which is still going, which I started with, is the Arkiva Awards. I got into frightful trouble from one or two people for starting a rival awards. I remember Jenny Abramski immediately went away and started a BBC Awards for radio, which fine enough, then, Jenny, on you go. And having her own radio festival and all that sort of thing, which I thought was unfortunate, but I can fully understand why she did it.
Gareth's debut single marked his third and final appearance on the Pepsi chart, the best of 2002, and the ninth cover version to feature by selling over 850,000...
I think I've said before, possibly I shouldn't have done, but I think it's true, I think I was pretty radioed out by that stage, really. My interest started to subside, really, when the Pepsi chart died, because I put a lot of effort into the Pepsi chart, and it was called the Pepsi chart because of me. And so, in a regulatory sense, we'd fought the radio authority and they agreed that it should be called the Pepsi chart and all that sort of stuff. Or was it the, whoever it was, that we had to have a go at in order to get that. And it was a huge success. And it made the radio stations a good deal of money. We had to fight between all the radio stations claiming it and the ones who were, you must be familiar with all of that nonsense. But nonetheless, I thought that was quite good. And it was the beginning, and it was when sort of EMAP sort of stepped outside the frame, really, and said, no, we're going to go and do what we want to do and let the rest of the radio industry sort itself out. That wasn't the case in external affairs and all those other things that the trade association did. But nonetheless, it spelt that those days were gone. And when we went through the whole business of closing down CRCA and RAB and creating the Radio Centre, which has, I think, worked well. I think it's working very well now, and where the emphasis quite rightly is on the marketing side rather than, although external affairs are still important. I'd got there and I'd done that, and that my new contract said, this is what you've got to do, and clearly there was bits of falling out that went on. It's various changes had to be made in order to do that. And I quite enjoyed my 2 years as chairman of that, and I was very glad to be able to find a successor who was, in terms of her networking ability and knowledge and position in media, was significantly superior to anything I could bring to the game. And so I was very happy to sort of step back, really, and go away thinking, now what am I going to do next? And I managed to find things to do, and I've quite enjoyed them. I was happiest making commercials. I'm a tolerably good voiceover artist, but I love making commercials. And the people that I enjoyed working with most were commercial producers. I mean, my attention span is not what it should be, but what I love about commercials is that you've got to have something which is really, really impactful or really, really funny and relevant to the product or whatever it is you're trying to promote and all those sorts of things. And when you've done a good job, you go, oh, that's a good job. And you hear it, it's a good job, then you move on to the next thing. I really like that. So of all the things I miss, I don't miss being on the radio. I never did really miss being on the radio because I was so at it. But I did miss making commercials. I think I'd like to be remembered as being someone who made a bit of a difference on the regulatory side, because I think I did do a lot of deregulation while I was a regulator. And I did the sort of things that needed to be done for the people that we were regulating, as well as for the listeners. Because I think it's a two-way thing. But I don't think you have contented listeners if you have radio stations that are perpetually chafing against ridiculous rules. And I think I got rid of a lot of those, and I'm pleased with that.